from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, Gloria Steinem's first book in 20 years is called My Life on the Road, and in it she chronicles her travels as a journalist and an activist visiting college campuses across the United States. Steinem sees travel as a transformative act, a way to truly understand the rich diversity of people in the United States, and for her, travel is also a way for women to escape their traditional place in the home, to get away from expectations, and to grow. We'll discuss her memoir with her and get her thoughts on the effort to defund Planned Parenthood, Hillary Clinton's presidential bid, and the state of feminism today. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Journalist, lecturer, activist, editor, and leading feminist, Gloria Steinem joins us for this second Forum Hour, and she's an award-winning journalist. Also the co-founder of Ms. Magazine, one of the founders of New York Magazine, and the author of many books, including Revolution from Within, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, Moving Beyond Words, and most recently a memoir, My Life on the Road, her first book in two decades. In 2013, she received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama, and we welcome her back to the Forum program. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, let's talk about your book. So many things to talk with you about, but I want to talk about the dedication, which begins the book. But before we do that, I want to talk about actually the first thing that we are immersed in, which is a meeting with a lot of motorcyclists in the Badlands of South Dakota. And there you are with a group of women thinking, there's too much testosterone here, or something along those lines, I deduced.
Yes, we'd seen all those movies about bad motorcyclists. And also, I must say on our behalf that there were 250,000 of them.
So, but little did you know, and this seemed to be revelatory to me as a reader about what you were getting at in this book. It was a good way to begin the book because you never know what you're going to meet or who you're going to meet on the road. It's a kind of populism that's unpredictable. And here you meet this woman and pick up the story from that point.
Well, we had been trying to avoid the motorcyclists. We were there for in Indian country, really, for a powwow that was celebrating the return to the traditional status, we hope, of women in various nations and tribes. So we were somewhat separated from these folks that we feared. But one morning I came into the motel dining room and they were all there, you know, tons of people in chains and tattoos and nose rings and, you know, and so I'm trying to be cool and open-minded at the same time. But of course, I'm not being open-minded. So I was sitting there having breakfast and next to me was a very fat, scary-looking guy and his very older biker chick kind of a partner. And I could see they were aware of me in some way. So finally, the woman came over and said, you know, I really like Ms. Magazine, she said. And now that my husband is retired, you know, I get him to read some too. And then she said, isn't one of the women that you're with Alice Walker? I really love her poetry. It was such a lesson. But the greatest thing was that she looked out the window and pointed to her purple Harley and explained to me how difficult and important it was that she had finally got a motorcycle of her own and so was not always riding on the back of her husband's motorcycle.
And we should mention Alice Walker, color purple.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, no, you're quite right. I never thought of that. Until you said that, I never thought of that. And she even had Ms. on the license plate, and she was explaining to me about the Badlands, which are right next door, and anybody who's been there knows it's like a moonscape, you know, when you look at it. She said, oh, you should see my grandkids when, you know, Grandma rides up on a purple Harley.
Did she also tell you her husband was reading Ms. too?
Yes. Oh, she said sometimes, now that he's retired, she said he sometimes reads Ms.
That's a delightful story.
Yeah, and it was so emblematic for me. I couldn't get it out of my head because I thought, first of all, everything close up is different from anything far away. The bikers, the Badlands, which turn out to have multiple colors, even though it looks like the desert. Everything is different close up, one. And two, we all have a purple Harley inside us somewhere. We just need to find it, get on it, and ride.
And we all have that inner child, too, because you wrote about that in your last book, which we featured here on Forum. And your father took you on the road. I mean, he was antique salesman, and he essentially traveled with you. So it was instilled in you at an early age to go out and meet people and have these kind of encounters that were surprising and in some ways, obviously, illuminating, enlightening.
Mm-hmm. No, it was. But I think because as a child, this was all before I was 10, we spent most of the year in house trailers. And my father was very proud of never having a job. That was one of his big points of pride. So he was always buying and selling, you know, small antiques along the way to get us to wherever we were going. And I was busily rebelling against it because I had been to the movies. I saw that kids, you know, lived in houses and went to school. And, you know, I thought I wanted that. And it took me a long time to come back to it. I think this happens to a lot of us with our childhood patterns. You come back to it and appreciate it, but in a different way, because my father actually never had a home. He was always on the road. And my mother never had a journey of her own. So I think my discovery in the course of writing this book is that
putting home and journey together?
Yeah, that I and I think most of us, kind of primordially speaking, need both.
Yeah.
I mean, even birds have nests.
Well, you also grew up with this notion that the right, almost obligatory thing to do was to marry and have children and somewhere.
There was no alternative, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one relative, a distant cousin, who had not married and not had children, and people said she was crazy. And in fact, she was crazy. So it was not a great example.
So all of this early history that you had had so much to do with shaping you and continues even at this octogenarian stage. This is what 80 looks like, right?
Yes.
When you were 70,
it's
people
a shock,
said,
I have to say.
Say, you don't look 70, and you said, this is what 70 looks like.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, it's and as Joan Didion said to me, I guess it wasn't original with her, old age is not for sissies, right?
Yes, that was Bette Davis.
It was Bette Davis originally, right. See, you have so many analogs with movies. You remember talking about the motorcyclists, talking about the homes you saw in the movies, and now we got the Bette Davis. Movies shaped you. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think they shape us in an interesting way. Suzanne Langer, who is a greatly neglected American philosopher, says that books are in and of themselves time past. You may fight it and write science fiction, but the fact of a book is time past. Plays are present, no matter what, and movies are dreams. And that's why they have such power.
Well, you know what else has power is the dedication of this book. I alluded to it. It's to a doctor in London, and a doctor by the name of John Sharp, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India. And that, of course, was Gloria Steinem. I'm reading from the book here, from the dedication. And it's dedicated to him because he took a chance, big chance, obviously, but also something he said to you, which was a pearl of wisdom that you took to heart.
Yeah, he said, he was such a kind man. And I had just found his name in the phone book. It wasn't as if I knew what I was doing at all. And he said, you must just promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. He was risking his profession, really. And also, you will do what you want to do with your life. So understanding that he, who was an older man even then, you know, in the 50s, could not possibly be alive, it suddenly occurred to me that I could finally pay tribute to him and say, you know, I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you.
And you've brought so much progress and so much change, and yet I wonder, I found myself reflecting, after reading this dedication, what does Gloria Steinem think about now what's going up against Planned Parenthood? I mean, it's major.
Well, I hope that over the years I've come to understand why. I would have been much more mystified by it now that the vast majority of Americans agree that the question that reproductive decisions, including abortion, should be left up to a woman and her physician, not politicians. So it isn't as if they have the majority. And in fact, they're fighting back with special fervor because they don't have the majority. They didn't get the Human Life Amendment into the Constitution via Washington in the states that they wanted. So, and they seem to have been surprised that murdering abortion doctors and bombing clinics didn't make them popular. So instead now, the anti—
Are these all the same group you're talking
about? They're
all
the same groups, yeah. Except I think that now the question of immigration has been added to their number because they're— I'm not saying all of them, but I think the heart of them is motivated by the fact that in about 2 minutes, the country's not going to be a majority white or European-American country anymore. And so you get the same groups that are against immigration, against abortion, contraception, even sex education now. Because they say, you know, they just say to you up front, you know, the white race is committing suicide in their view. I mean,
it sounds like the right-wing conspiracy, as Hillary Clinton called it almost.
Well, it's a cultural conspiracy. I mean, their sense of identity really hinges on hierarchy. And a lot of them feel it's religiously ordained. But I would go back to something even more basic than that, which is that reproduction is the most important single point of both individual freedom and versus that collective control. Our economics courses, really speaking, ought to start with reproduction, not production. We ignore the degree to which controlling the means of reproduction, which means women's bodies, is fundamental to nationalism, to how many workers, how many soldiers, to and to keeping racial groups separate, and to keeping religious groups and class and caste in India. I mean, you know, patriarchy did not really arrive in India until the caste system, and then it became important to control women's bodies. So I just say that because now I realize it's basic and I'm less shocked by the opposition of a minority to the majority.
But it is a minority.
But it is a minority,
as you pointed
right.
out. Again, we're talking to Gloria Steinem, author of a new book called My Life on the Road. It would appear at this point that Hillary Clinton is a likely nominee from the Democratic Party. And I know you went through a lot of Sturm und Drang over backing her as opposed to backing Obama back in the day.
For a long time I was backing both. You know, people used to say to me, "You backing Obama or Hillary Clinton?" I would say, "Yes." But she had so much more experience that I ended up endorsing her.
Right? And wound up, there's a wonderful picture of you with the president. Your eyes are closed and his arm is around you and he's giving you the presidential
medal. And then we worked our hearts out to elect him. You know, I so regret that there was this horrendous evil, you know, which is more important, sex or race? Excuse me, that is an unanswerable question, thing that the media was doing. It was very, very painful.
It's also been, and this gets to your book, because you write about the Hillary haters, as you call them, and trying to understand them because so many of them are like her. They're white, they're well-educated. And you came to a conclusion, in fact, Michelle Goldberg wrote about this, and she wrote, she said she reveres you, but she said she was pretty harsh in her language. She said you were condescending and insulting and misogynistic even was a word that she used because – and see if I get this right about your theory. You thought that the theory was that Hillary Clinton was rejected and made these women angry for the most part because they saw a kind of equal partnership and they didn't have it in their marriages. And they also thought that there should have been some punishment
to
her husband.
They wanted her to punish Bill, really, by leaving him or publicly punishing him in some way because they couldn't. You know, I'm not I'm not saying this was true of everybody. I was just talking about the groups of women I was addressing and who actually, once they were in a room with Hillary, often changed because they came to understand she was a great girlfriend, you know, that she really was open to them.
And you wrote about her talking about problems in Yugoslavia, for example, and really getting a strong responsiveness. But I wonder also, go back to the last campaign when she said she was under fire in Bosnia and there were these videos that pretty much said that's not true. It was simply not true. And people don't trust her. And I guess in some people's minds, it has nothing to do necessarily with the kind of reasons we're psychoanalyzing from this perspective.
Well, you know, it isn't as if I am inside anybody else's head but my own. And I've observed her over the years. I've introduced her once in a while to some speaking group. We've never had lunch by ourselves, you know. But I find her a miracle of courage. I mean, she has faced such huge opposition and
still
such,
does.
Such viciousness. I mean, if I never would have run for the Senate if I'd been her. I would never would have wanted to see Washington again, you know, after what she went through as First Lady, being accused of affairs and murdering somebody and, you know, all the scandals in Arkansas. You know, there was $1 million a month being spent on accusing the two of them. Also, I think that she maybe should get a button that says, I wasn't born a Clinton, because, you know, it's not as if she's the same person as her husband. She's quite a different person.
Maybe should have run under the name Rodham, maybe, huh?
But in any case, I worry that we spend too much time talking about the candidates above us instead of what are they doing instead of talking about what are we going to do.
What about also, just to go back for a moment, to Bill Clinton's administration, there was criticism of you for staying as a supporter of Bill Clinton, particularly when some felt that he acted very cavalierly with women and, you know, was not respectful to women and so forth.
Clearly wrote that he needed sex therapy. He needed a therapist. You know, I was certainly not without.
But were the issues more important than?
No, it wasn't that. The issues are never more important than personal behavior. It's that I was listening to the women involved, and, you know, especially to Monica Lewinsky, who under all pressure from being entrapped by the FBI and, you know, with no preparation and everything subsequently, refused to say that it was not her own free will. She would not say it was sexual harassment. She said, no, I was there because I wanted to be. And I respect that.
So many respect you for so many reasons, but there was always that bumper sticker that was attributed to you, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. And then,
yeah, I did not say that.
You did not say
that. No, I wish I did. I thought it was quite funny, but I don't have it in my mind right now, but it was a wonderful woman philosophy student in Australia who some philosopher had said, man needs God like a fish needs a bicycle. And she had just rewritten it on the ladies' room wall, and it went, you know, what we now would say viral, but at the time it was on T-shirts and it went around the world and so on. And I kept on saying, who said this? I can send it to you. I have her letter pinned on my wall.
Who
really said it?
But when you did marry David Bell, and condolences again, because I know it was a terrible loss when he died, a lot of people said, Gloria Steinem's getting married? You know, does she need a man? Does she need a husband?
Well, I think, how shall I say, it was so different by then. I mean, we'd spent 30 years changing the marriage laws. So I suddenly realized, wait a minute, you know, I no longer would lose my name, my credit rating, my legal domicile, and most of my civil rights. We've spent 30 years equalizing the marriage laws. That's one thing. And the second thing was that, yes, we were in love and we wanted to be together, but he had been born in South Africa and he was having visa problems. The only sure way to cure them, to get a green card, was to be married. I thought, well, we've spent all these years changing the institution's negatives. Why not use one of its positives? But what made the difference totally, I have to say, was that Wilma Mankiller offered us a Cherokee ceremony. In Oklahoma.
That did it. Huh?
That did it.
So you about Wilma Mankiller, who was actually the chief of the Cherokee Nation and was a great ally of yours, as was Flo Kennedy. It always seemed like there was an attempt to diversify the feminist movement and have, you know, Native Americans, African Americans.
But, you know, it wasn't – it's the other way around. They are the feminist movement.
No, I know. In fact, you've said publicly that African American women began the feminist movement.
Well, and even before that, you know, before Columbus showed up, the cultures that were here were by and large matrilineal and what we would now say egalitarian cultures. So patriarchy and male dominance was imported, and women in Indian country make jokes about it because if you don't laugh, you die. You know, so what did Columbus call primitive? Equal women.
Was it frustrating, though, to try to I mean, because the movement was for a long time identified mainly as white privileged women or white bourgeois women, despite the leadership that we're talking about here. Yeah.
I mean, nothing is wrong because we all have different experiences. So somebody, you know, may well have experienced that. I can only say that I didn't experience that. The first women I ever knew who had done a feminist analysis of social policy was the National Welfare Rights Organization. And they had done a witty and brilliant examination of welfare as a gigantic husband that looked for the shoes of other men underneath your bed and kept you on just enough to survive but not enough to rebel. It was brilliant.
There is, remember, in fact, actually the last program we did together, you were starting a radio network, a feminist radio network with Jane Fonda and Robin Morgan were here.
Greenstone all Radio,
studio, right?
Yeah.
But there was a time before that when you came in with some of the younger women who were involved in Ms. Magazine, who were the next generation. I think Amy Richards would have been one, and Jessica Neuwirth.
They were involved. Jessica Neuwirth had started Equality Now, which is a very important global women's rights, human rights group. And Amy Richards and I have been working together, you know, for more than 20 years. And by now she's written more books than me, does more lectures than me. So they weren't directly associated with the magazine.
So how do you feel about the carrying on of the torch, though? I mean, you know, the next generation, I mean, fourth wave, fifth wave, I don't know where we are exactly, but just really keeping it alive, what you have dedicated your life to.
Well, it's alive, you know. I mean, it's, you know, more active among young women than it was in my generation by far. But I get really angry at the torch imagery because people say to me, you know, who are you going to pass the torch to? So here's what I've evolved to try to change the imagery. First of all, I'm not giving up my torch. Thank you very much. I'm keeping my torch. Secondly, I'm using it to light the torches of other people because if we don't each have a torch, how do we know where we're going? You know, the whole image of one torch is such a hierarchical image. We each need a torch.
Here she is, Lady Liberty, with us in studio, Gloria Steinem. Let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation. If you have a question or comment for Gloria Steinem, reflecting on a feminist life on the road in her new book, My Life on the Road, and also encouraging us, like the old Chevrolet advertisements, to see the USA in whatever automobile or vehicle you might be in. We welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available now, and that number is 866-733-6786. Welcome your calls. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Again, we welcome your involvement in the program. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Gloria Steinem. Her new book is My Life on the Road, and in it she chronicles travels as a journalist and an activist, visiting college campuses and traveling across the United States, and sees travel as a transformative act, a way to truly understand the rich diversity of people in the United States. And for her, travel is also a way for women to escape their traditional place in the home, to get away from expectations and to grow. We're talking about a number of things with her. I was just talking with her off air about one of her former lovers, Mort Zuckerman, who, and you are very open about your lovers. Big plus with him was being a good dancer. That's very important to you.
Yes.
What kind of dancing are we talking about?
And a sense of humor. No, dancing like, you know, social dance. I mean, you know, I suppose discotheque dancing, that describes it.
We're going to go to our callers and emailers here. But one of the things just I wanted to get to in your book that I was really struck by was crossing the DMZ. I mean, the longest day in your life, you say. Mm-hmm.
You know, every once in a while you get called into a travel situation you could not possibly have imagined on your own. And this was one because women from the diaspora, the Korean diaspora, had, and especially Christine Ahn, who's from was from here in San Francisco, AHN, people may know her, who was a brilliant organizer, had put together 30 women from around the globe to do a peace walk across the DMZ, the so-called demilitarized zone, which is not at all demilitarized, it is full of landmines, between North and South Korea, because it has been there for almost 50 years, though it was meant to be there for a matter of months during an armistice that was supposed to have preceded peace talks, and peace talks have never happened. And that still divides families on both sides, on either side of the zone. And it had come to seem almost permanent. So we hoped that by being, you might say, surrogate walk peace walkers, because citizens of North and South Korea can't cross. And we did manage to get permission from both North and South Korea, which was a triumph in itself for two countries that don't agree. We could bring attention to this last relic, really, of World War II and the Korean War, and bring some pressure of public opinion towards taking the landmines out and beginning the peace talks that were supposed to happen almost half a century ago. But going to North Korea, which you can only enter through China, so we went to Beijing first, was, I must say, it's the most controlled and repressive place I've ever been. They even ask you when you enter if you have books, for instance, and the internet is controlled, and where people live is assigned to them. The number of calories they can eat is somewhat assigned to them. But on the other hand, they, of course, people like anywhere else. And the country is beautiful,
People like anywhere else, and yet under such Orwellian control.
Yeah.
There's a young woman, in fact, who wrote a memoir you may know about. She escaped from North Korea. She became a defector and everything. And it's what Blake would have called mind-forged manacles. She couldn't rid herself of them, you know, because to think independently is to be in defiance.
The closest parallel to me emotionally while I was there was a controlling was domestic violence, you know, situations in which a head of household controls the whole household, you know, how much you can eat, what's in the refrigerator, you know, is physically violent, is, you know, we see these situations domestically, and this is like a national version of that. And it invades your head, you know, because you are so convinced that the Stockholm syndrome takes over. So you are so dependent on the whims and approval of the person in power that you almost lose your will. And, you know, that they call it a communist regime is certainly an insult to Marx and Engels, who I think would have just flipped if they could see, you know,
and even maybe
hereditary.
Lenin. Yeah. I want to go to our callers, but I want to go first to something I was one other thing I was struck by in your book, and then read a comment, a question here, a big question raised by one of our women listeners. When I read your book, I would have thought, like Judy Collins was on last week, and we were talking about her memoir, and like so many women, she said, feminism saved my life. And often feminism is synonymous with Gloria Steinem in many of these young women's minds, because you.
But I feel it shouldn't be. I mean, I feel the same kind of crazed gratitude. You know, it's.
But you say librarians saved your life.
Yes, well, and librarians were often early feminists. You know, because they they were in an all female profession, and they could see what the problems were.
But they fed you books, and,
yes.
And books are so
yes.
important to you.
Yes, absolutely.
So here's Kate, who writes. Big question: what if any unintended consequences came about as a result of the women's movement and the sexual revolution in terms of the relationships between men and women?
I think the paradigm of success in the culture is such a, I would say it's a masculine paradigm, but it imprisons men too, that the notion of success for women has become too tied up with a hierarchical corporate notion of success. I do believe that there are many, both men and women, who are questioning this, but it's hard to, in the teeth of the worship of money and the idea that if you're rich or smart, which Trump alone should disprove.
Did you read the article by Michael Kinsley in the New Vanity Fair?
No.
He just basically says people need to understand most about Trump is he's a buffoon. builds up to that kind of statement. But this listener was asking about sex and relationships, because there are those who say once the sexual revolution opened things up, suddenly the idea of freedom, long overdue for women sexually, turned into somehow hooking up. And you hear this argument, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure that's true in individual cases, but I think overall the idea that women are not passive in sex, that there is no such thing as the vaginal orgasm, which Freud was telling us there for many years, and we were immature if we didn't have a kind of orgasm that didn't exist. That
he also said women don't have a superego. I mean, he says some pretty extraordinarily foolish things.
You know, that women are and men are sexual, sensual beings, and that we managed to do things like explaining that rape was not sex, it was violence, which is pretty basic.
Thank you, Susan Brown Miller.
Yes, Susan Brown Miller. And now that we are seeing exposure of sexual assault in the military on campuses and so on, I mean, I think I would say it's at least 70% positive. A positive improvement.
But there's more, like the article, you see the statistics going up, for example, for sex trafficking. It must be demoralizing to you.
Yeah, no. It's, I mean, when you equalize relationships that have not been equal before, whether by sex or race or class or caste, you get a certain number of people who are addicted to control, who can't democratize, who can't give up, you know, their place, their greater place in the hierarchy. They're literally addicted to it. And so that takes a sexual form. It takes a racist form. You know, you get an extreme backlash, and we do have an extreme backlash. And also just because of the ease of travel now, sex trafficking is a form of sex and labor trafficking is a form of individual slavery that is physically more possible by far than it was in the days when we think of as the days of slavery. So it endures as a source of profit.
Easier profit than trying to smuggle drugs, it turns out, in fact. Let me bring our callers on here. Terry, you're on. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Hi, Michael. Hi, Gloria.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I wondered what you thought about what young women think about feminism now, and equality, and how they sort of manifest that in the world. I'm a retired IBEW electrician of 27 years, and unfortunately, I have to say that it seemed like it got even more difficult the more years I had in. And I'm not sure that the young women understand, how much work there is still to be done. Okay, so there's that. And then I also wondered, how do you think we can get men to participate in the change in the culture? You know, much like the Black Lives Matter, you see a lot of white people becoming involved in trying to change the system. So,
well, I think that young women are way, way, way more activist than their mothers and grandmothers ever were. They're concerned about sexual assault on campus. They're mad as hell that they're graduating in a huge amount of debt, but going to earn about $1 million less over their lifetime than men to pay it back. They have much greater assumptions about what they should be able to do and can do. And, you know, as for Black Lives Matter, remember that this, you know, very big and important and decentralized movement was started by three young black women who clearly consider themselves feminists and queer, which means, you know, escaping gender roles altogether, and I so admire them. They have three rules of organizing that are so wonderful. wait a minute. One is, can I read them? I always carry them with me.
You don't want to be like Rick Perry here. You get the first two and you don't get the third.
Yeah, no, because I'm so impressed with them. this is sort of embarrassing to be searching through my purse on the radio here.
It's very human, Gloria. It's okay.
Okay. The first one is lead with love. The second one is low ego, high impact. And the third one is move with the speed of trust. How great is that?
Very nice.
So I feel really good about the future in their hands.
Let me thank the caller. Well, actually, yeah, getting men involved, though, and getting men vested, the listener wanted to know, too. And I'm actually looking at a number of questions along those lines. How do I get my son to be more feminist-minded and so forth?
You know, I think that we should acknowledge the vast numbers of men who are involved in preventing violence against women, striving to have work patterns that allow them to be close to their kids, you know, so that there's parental leave rather than only maternal leave. And, you know, the situation of who raises kids has changed substantially for many men. And this is crucial not only for the kids who will grow up knowing that men can be loving and nurturing and so on, but it's crucial for the men because the way men escape the masculine prison is and develop those qualities wrongly called feminine, attention to detail, patience, flexibility. Those are just what you need to raise kids. So men become whole people in that way, in just as women become whole people by being active outside the house, assertive, daring. And the goal for both of us is to have access to our full circle of human qualities. So, you know, I think that the key to it is the men who understand it as reward, not punishment. You know, that they're that. And similarly, I would say with the ideas about race, I think the Americans who celebrate our diversity and see it as an advantage to everyone and that we're going to understand the world better, other countries more, you know, are really the reliable allies.
We'll bring in actually a male caller. Rick is calling us from Fresno. And Rick, you want to talk about a men's group you started, huh?
Yeah, good morning, Michael. Good morning, Gloria. I'm an example of a man who has experienced feminism as a reward, not punishment. In 1972, I think it was, Gloria, you came to speak at Yale University. And a group of my male friends and I came to that speech, and after that speech started a men's group that continues to this day. That's, I guess, we're in year 43. And throughout my life, that group and the relationships and the values that I've learned from being in that group has spread to all parts of my life as a husband, as a father of two strong, wonderful daughters, in my vocation, in my community work, helping start the first, what was called a battered women's shelter in New Haven, Connecticut. You really were an important key to that life. So I just wanted to call and thank you and acknowledge the role you played for me and the men that were in that are in that group and many other men who have started men's groups coming out of that group.
No, I so appreciate your call because you're living this and you're saying that it is an expansion and a plus, a move forward for all of us. And that helps so much. You know, human beings work on yes, not no. Or at least we work better on yes than we do on no, right? Mm-hmm. So I thank you for living it.
Yeah, I thank Rick for the call. And let me bring another caller on here. Teresa, join us. You're on. Hi.
Hi. I have a question and a comment, and I'd like to know if there's anything I don't know about movements in the country to make reparations to fix what's wrong with Social Security if women divorce, and especially in later life. After spending decades working in the home, raising children, and doing civic work, and then our laws are such that a man will get full Social Security and a woman at best can get one half of that. And if a man waits until he's age 70, he will get three times the amount of Social Security as a wife.
Yes, the Social Security situation has, you know, a lot of flaws, a lot of old-fashioned assumptions in it. And, you know, there are so many economic – we need that economic reform. And we also need to attribute an economic value to caregiving, whether done by women or men, at replacement level and make that sum tax deductible if people pay taxes or tax refundable as a much better means of figuring out welfare. Because right now, a third of the work in the country and very necessary work without which the country couldn't function is caregiving, whether for children or elderly parents or the ill or, you know.
And isn't like 70% of that women who do the caretaking?
Yeah,
around that
than,
figure.
It's, yeah, it's more than 70%, actually. It's close. It depends where you look, but it's often close to 90%. And it there's no way of estimating it because we attribute no economic value to it, which is ridiculous. It would be helpful for the country to reward in a sensible way that work which is done at home because by and large, not always, but by and large, it's better done at home and certainly less expensive than in institutions. So why not? We could do this. Some other countries have done this. Just attribute an economic value to caregiving at replacement level and make it tax deductible. It's not brain science. You know,
sounds
we could
like
do
Bernie
this.
Sanders a little bit. Let me thank the caller and go to a Facebook comment from Beth who writes, here it is, the end of 2015, and women in Hollywood and high tech are denouncing lower pay from men. Sons of the women from the second wave of feminism are as sexist as ever, more forms of contraception than ever, yet millions of abortions are done each year. Women who would love to be stay-at-home parents cannot afford the choice. Just what successes outside of themselves has Ms. Steinem and those of her inner circle brought other women?
I don't know where to begin on this string of facts, but I think they are more like factoids because even though we don't have equal pay, we've moved toward equal pay. In the movies, you know, this is the first kind of major onslaught on the whole notion of unequal pay for female stars versus male stars. There are bankable male stars who are saying they won't be in movies unless women get paid equally. The number of abortions has not increased. It has actually
slipped, I think.
It has decreased somewhat. Obviously, this is not a procedure one would choose. So if the availability of sex education and contraception is what makes a difference, not outlawing abortion, which makes no difference except to endanger the lives of the women who then have to seek it. So I think maybe, how shall I say? I'm not questioning that this is the experience of the person who's calling. Maybe it is, but it's not the majority experience.
I read a question from a listener named Maria. She says, do you think you wouldn't have been able to have your own life if you'd had your baby at 22? I think when we're very young, we could be short-sighted. It would have been a different evolution, but you'd have a family now. Any regrets?
No. Mm-mm. I'm speaking for myself, but I so needed to give birth to myself before giving – I could not have given birth to someone else and also given birth to myself. It would have transformed my life. I was on my way to India. I was engaged, you know, broken off the engagement and fled. It would have been a disaster for both of us, though we remained friends for the rest of our lives. It would have been a disaster for both of us if we had married.
What do you make of in fact, we've done shows on the increase of rape in India and some of the more horrible cases and so forth. And one has to ask, was this just for the most part kept hidden and under the surface?
Yeah, I don't know that there's evidence that it's on the increase. And on the contrary, it's probably now being exposed more and therefore, you know, in a terrible way that we are learning terrible truths is probably necessary. But, up to now, there have not only been many rape cases, but a judge I remember who said that what once was called untouchable, and then Gandhi called who refer to themselves as Dalits, the chosen yes. ones, but the lowest caste or casteless, that no such woman could be raped. By definition, he said, a low caste woman can't be raped. So, you know, that's where the state of mind has been in the past. Now that there's consciousness, they actually, after the famous New Delhi rape, there was a commission put together with two very distinguished, one male, one female, legal authorities at the head of it. And they ended up with a document that is really more advanced about sexual harassment, sexual assault, and so on than anything we have. So as bad as it is, I think it's revealing the truth and beginning to change.
Bring another caller on, and that's you, Jeannie. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. Gloria, hi. I was actually at City Arts and Lectures last night, and I was lucky enough to have to ask you a question about birth. And you had a very important comment, which was that unlike many European countries, including England, who just gave a very official advisory that women with uncomplicated births birth at home with a midwife, you mentioned that here in America it's very much economical and that the obstetricians and the organizations around them just don't want the competition. And I would really love to hear from you about what it's going to take for women as individuals to have a control, to understand they have control over their bodies, and to know that they have the autonomy and that how to get a hold of that fear that is often, I think, exploited, right, for the business. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that I think before issues like maternity leave or parental leave can even be addressed, we need to really address how we value the quality of birth.
Yeah, Jeannie, mm-hmm. raising some good questions. Let's hear from Gloria Steinem.
Well, I thank you for calling and for your question last night, because you're pointing out the fact that in England, the understanding that home births are possible and often preferable is way, way, way more advanced than it is here. And she was asking why. And in my experience, it so far seems quite economic that the obstetricians, not all obstetricians, some welcome it, but overall, in terms of state regulations and, you know, the regulations that govern birth, don't welcome home births and midwives in the same way that they do in other countries. And that obviously needs to be changed. And I think usually the answer is just doing it, you know, finding a midwife who you like, finding a doctor who will be on call if necessary, but who understands the value of home birth, and just doing it and publicizing it as this woman is doing.
Listener named Ramona writes on our Facebook page, she's addressing this to me, stop discounting Bernie Sanders as a viable or improbable Democratic nominee. I just said that I thought Hillary Clinton was a likely nominee. I'm not discounting Senator Sanders. But she goes on to say, the media's continual promotion of Hillary Clinton as a presumptive nominee is exactly what keeps people from embracing and listening to his message, as Bernie Sanders' message of government reform. In other words, government by the people. Stop electing our president in the press. And someone else adds, Bernie Sanders is more feminist than Hillary Clinton in so many ways. So I'll get a comment from you.
You know, I agree to some extent, but what the press is doing is reporting public opinion polls, basically. So way more shocking to me is the idea that Donald Trump is treated as a front runner when he seems to me per se impossible as a president, just because he is. But we have to take some responsibility for those public opinion polls.
Here's Mark from Berkeley. He writes, I appreciate what you say about the contributions of women of color to the feminist cause, but you seem not to want to acknowledge that there is a very real negative perception of white feminism. There is a feeling that the movement, as embodied by the young and privileged, is not very concerned with social justice and equity for others. This is a perception that seems widely felt among young women of color, the very people whose energy and enthusiasm the feminist movement needs to keep vibrant.
No, I agree. And I think the other thing that this perception does is to wipe out the reality and record and history of the women of color who have always been part of the women's movement, or have been the women's movement, actually. So, you know, we need to go back and honor those women from Sojourner Truth forward who have always been there, assuming, I mean, I have no problem with identifying and trying to fix any the examples of racism that, of course, are in the women's movement. Of course, we must do that. But to declare ownership of the women's movement by white women is to render invisible those women of color who have pioneered it.
We've come to the end of the hour. Always good to have you, Gloria. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Gloria Steinem, and again, her newest book, The First in 20 Years, is called My Life on the Road. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online. In fact, encourage you to do so, kqed.org/forum. And you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, again, thanks for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.